This is the best album you've never heard. Hello and welcome to The Best Album You've Never Heard, the podcast that introduces its guests to new music with me, Colin French. If this is your first time you've listened, the premise is simple. I give my guests an album they've never listened to before, then we sit down and we have a chat about it and we talk about music in general. Today I'm joined by Doug McPherson. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this, Doug. How are you today?
I'm really good. Thanks very much for the invite, Colin.
No, an absolute pleasure. As always, right, let's start at the beginning. Doug, what's your story with music? Is there a particular moment it clicked with you? Has it always been there? How has that evolved?
I guess it has always been there, not in a sense that people would find particularly exciting. My dad was a massive Sinatra fan. My mum was a massive Jack Jones fan. So there was always a bit of crooning going on in the house. But I suppose my epiphanal moment, if you like, was seeing The Jam doing Town Called Malice on Top of the Pops, which kind of influenced me from there on in. I don't know when that would have been, 1981-ish, I would think. But, you know, from there, that's kind of dictated the music that I've listened to ever since, right up to the present day. Because on one side, you had, you know, what I call the sort of Weller generation bands. You know, it took me through the House Martins, the Wonder Stuff, Stone Roses, Blur, right up to Oasis, all the bands that were sort of, you know, name-checking Weller. And on the other side, following the Style Council, kind of took me into jazz, soul, hip-hop, all of that kind of stuff, which, you know, that's kind of all the music that's buzzed around my head for the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because when you talk about the Jam and Weller, obviously, you know, the Jam, Weller's solo stuff, but Style Council stuff. Weller's an artist that wasn't afraid to, you know, put his finger in different pies, as it were.
No, and if you think about, I mean, I don't know how old you are or how well you remember it, but I remember kids coming to school with black armbands on their blazers because the Jam had split up. That's how much they meant to people. And I think once you sort of got a bite of that, you know, you'd bitten into the Jam and you'd invested in the Jam, all of a sudden you were looking at, well, if they did David Watts, that's not a Paul Weller song. Who's that? Oh, it's Ray Davies. Well, Ray Davies is the Kinks, right? I've got to listen to the Kinks. Or, you know, where's he got that haircut from? Oh, it's from the Small Faces. Right, I'll listen to the Small Faces. And then obviously Town Called Malice itself is basically a Motown riff. So, you know, you've got big brothers and big sisters of my pals at the time saying, right, well, why don't you just borrow this Motown compilation? So you start listening to that, then you start listening to Northern Soul. And I'm an obsessive. I'll go down any rabbit hole and pull it apart. And that's, but it's kind of the ground zero, if you like, was the Jam doing Town Called Malice on Top of the Pops. And everything just sort of fell out of that.
That isn't a bad starting point for an introduction to music, is it, The Jam?
No. And, you know, I'd be very, very doubtful that anybody listening to this wouldn't, you know, have heard The Jam, if not probably own their entire back catalogue. But if you haven't heard The Jam, there's a fantastic, I think it's 4 or 5 CD set called Direction, Reaction, Creation. I've probably got that the wrong way round, but just download it, just listen to it. The depth of the songwriting, the variety of genres that they cover is just, I mean, it's unreal. And, you know, added bonus, they were my local band because I grew up near Woking. So, you know, to suddenly find that the biggest band in Britain came from 3 miles down the road was just an added bonus.
I remember that box set. I bought that. It was quite a big box set, wasn't it, if I remember rightly?
Yes,
and
it came
with the CD covers were kind of card. They were like gatefold.
Yes.
I think I'm thinking about the same one. It might have had a booklet as well.
You're definitely thinking of the same one. And the booklet, I think, was the reason that that it did come in a slightly strange rectangular shape.
Yeah. I remember buying it. I'm 42, so I didn't, you know, the Jam were all done and dusted by the time I was getting into music. Weller's solo career was big, you know, around the time. I was probably 14, 15 when Stanley Road came out. And that was massive. I mean, that was a huge album.
Oh, it was a massive album. And I think that You know, the Livewood albums, another one that I remember particularly fondly, we used to go and see him an awful lot, basically anywhere around London and the home counties. And the first time we saw him was in a band called the Paul Weller Movement, which was just after they'd been booted off Polydor as the Style Council. And it was at Guildford Civic Hall, and there can't have been more than a couple of hundred people there. But, you know, by the time those solo albums started coming out, he was a massive deal. He was doing mini festivals in Victoria Park and, you know, really, really big venues, the Albert Hall and that kind of stuff. But I think where you got that crowd coming in was when you've got people like Damon Albarn, Noel Gallagher, all citing Weller as their main influence. And people just went back to revisit him. And, you know, I'm not pulling any punches. I'm not, you know, the Weller solo career's biggest fan, but they're good albums. And, you know, let's salute him, because if it wasn't for people like him and maybe Blur and Suede, we'd still be listening to Nirvana and the Smashing Pumpkins. So for that alone, the man deserves a row of medals.
So should I take that as in that kind of American alternative scene wasn't really your thing?
Anything sort of grungy, depressing, poorly dressed, long, greasy hair, I've got a real problem with. I don't have a problem with American things. You know, I'm not sitting here saying outside of the parameter of the Kinks, nothing's worth listening to unless it's a vignette postcard of quaint English life. No, not at all. I mean, there's an awful lot of American music I like. Hip hop's American, soul music's American. You know, things like Dinosaur Jr., I found them quite interesting. I quite like Husker Du. At some points, you know, there are American bands I like. I just didn't get grunge at all.
Yeah, okay. I mean, there's a lot of people that say that. The age I was at the time, I was really into a lot of those bands. I was listening to Sonic Youth, Mudhoney. Obviously, I listened to Nirvana and early Smashing Pumpkins and stuff. I was Pavement. I was into that whole sort of scene. But it was interesting when you were talking about that, Doug, that you mentioned kind of the scruffy, long hair nature and that. And I think, you know, coming from the background you have with like the Jam and then subsequent, you know, acts along the way and movements, you know, clothes were like such a massive part of that scene that I can totally understand why you thought that.
Absolutely. And, you know, by that sort of time, so what we'll be talking about there, 89, 90, I mean, I was headlong into the acid jazz thing because that was really the closest that anybody got to sort of that post-mod scene. So it's things like Galliano, Young Disciples, you know, that kind of stuff, what was coming out on Talking Loud and Acid Jazz, even the first Jamiroquai album, that was the stuff that was kind of making sense at that point. Then you got the first Suede album, then you got Modern Life is Rubbish by Blur, Paul Weller by Paul Weller, and then of course Oasis kicked in, and for me that was like, wow, that's like looking at my mates. All of a sudden, you've got sort of the mod sensibility, but you look like you've walked off a football terrace. And to me, that just made perfect sense. And, you know, I basically lived inside football grounds and gigs for most of the 90s, the worst for wear, and thoroughly loved it.
Yeah, the two did go hand in hand then. I mean, we should briefly mention we both support the same football team. We both support Chelsea Football Club.
Yes.
And you listen to another podcast I do, which is a football podcast, and that's kind of how we've connected, you know, in doing this now. But I started going to football, to Chelsea. I was probably, I might be 16. My parents weren't all that keen on me going when I was younger than that. And, you know, music and fashion was like, it felt indelibly linked with football as well, for me anyway.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And it's, I mean, now you've almost got, you know, most young people look fairly similar when you see them walking around. At that point, there was definitely a look if you went to the football. You were picked up as soon as, you know, you walked into a gig or you walked into a pub. But I think that just sort of added to the edge of it. And, you know, for me, and we've talked before, Colin, that wasn't the greatest time for fantastic football, although we were just starting to come into an era where Chelsea were starting to pick up pace and starting to pick up more of a position in the football league. But it just all sort of fell into place at that time and just felt right. So the music definitely went hand in hand for me with the football and with the clothes. For me, that's the holy triumvirate, and it's never really moved. And, you know, my children will kill me for telling this story because apparently I tell it all the time. But the best weekend of my life was Chelsea beating Middlesbrough in the FA Cup final. Then we went out to see the Charlatans, who were doing a Childline gig at Brixton. And completely unannounced, James Dean Bradfield did an acoustic set, and then Paul Weller and Noel Gallagher came on to do an acoustic set, and then obviously the Charlatans. And then we went to sleep, went back to Wembley and saw Woking beating Dagenham and Redbridge. That's the kind of weekends that we were having.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I mean, the Charlatans, I mean, that's the one we can touch on briefly, because I know that you're a big Charlatans fan.
Yeah, love them.
When you sent me your list of your 10 records you like, that I asked everyone for, the self-titled Charlatans album was in there. They made some great albums, the Charlatans. I felt like they never really got their due, in a way.
No, I think they got kind of eclipsed every time. So, I mean, the first time that I rubbed shoulders with what was to become the Charlatans, it was a band called Making Time. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. They were kind of a mob band from...
Nope.
From the mid-80s, from the West Midlands, and Martin Blunt, the bass player, and there was another original member of the Charlatans who I should be able to tell you and I can't remember, in Making Time. They obviously turned into the Charlatans. They were kind of taken over by the Stone Roses. And then when they came back the second time around, telling stories, the Charlatans, that sort of era, they were kind of trumped by Oasis. So they were always the bridesmaid and never the bride, which rankled with me a bit, because I think, you know, just even now they're releasing good albums. They've just been consistently brilliant and always a phenomenal live act.
Yeah, Tim Burgess has just released a solo album as well, which I have listened to it. I've only listened to it once, and it was okay. It didn't blow me away first time, but not, you know, albums tend to take a few times for me.
Yeah.
But during this whole pandemic and the lockdown situation, I've been so impressed with something that Tim Burgess has been doing on Twitter. I'm sure you've seen it. Tim's Listening Parties.
Yeah, fantastic.
He's done such a great job of them. I've done some of them, not as much as I'd like to have done, but I enjoyed every single one. And he's consistently, you know, doing 2-3 of them a night. It must be so much hard work.
And he's got the full backing of all the artists as well. You can see that straight away, you know, because you've actually got the people involved in those albums not sitting back, but taking front seat and talking about them.
No, absolutely. Everyone seems more than happy to get involved. It's a one. I know there's other listening parties happening on different platforms, Facebook and other people, but I mean that one it's just taken off. It's gone massive, and all the credit in the world to him. He's done a fantastic job.
And he's, I mean, obviously we're of a similar vintage, but he's picked the right albums as well. You know, it is the albums that people want to hear. Don't Stand Me Down by Dexys Midnight Runners, that being a fantastic example, which I think is another forgotten gem. You know, people talk about searching for the young soul rebels, and I think that I actually put that on my top 10 that I sent across to you, because it is,
you did, yeah,
probably Britain's greatest ever soul record. But, you know, Don't Stand Me Down is another phenomenal record that's just so easily forgotten. But Tim's dragged it out. So even for that alone, he gets my respect.
You've mentioned them a couple of times, and I think because we both would have felt the impact of them, let's talk about Oasis briefly.
Yes.
Because you would have been in a similar position to me, I guess. I mean, I heard Shaker Maker, wasn't it? It was the first single, so yes. I heard that first. And at the time, I worked in a record shop, so I had promos of them sort of early on, and I got a promo copy of Definitely Maybe, and I remember it kind of shaking my bones a bit.
Oh, 100%. I couldn't agree more. I was actually in Australia when Oasis came out, and we used to listen to a station called Triple J, which was, you know, the what they called an alternative station, in that it played Counting Crows instead of Midnight Oil. But all of a sudden, one of the DJs must have got hold of Supersonic. So they kind of skipped over Shaker Maker, and I heard Supersonic. I thought, this is absolutely unreal. And I was washing cars at the time, so I had my Walkman on all day with me, and I remember going out and buying Definitely Maybe and having exactly the same reaction. As soon as I heard Rock and Roll Star, there was just a whole charge went through your body, and you just thought, this is it, I've got to go back to England now, there's something happening. And I did.
Well, there was something happening around that time. Well, there was something happening, wasn't there? You mentioned Sway before. I don't particularly like the term Britpop, a bit like the term grunge. But I don't know what else to refer to those scenes as, because it's become so ingrained. Yeah, definitely. But I kind of feel like Suede were the first of those bands. They probably don't get thought of in that way, but the first Suede album was a great, great record. And as you're right, as you mentioned, it led on then to other bands that you call it Blur, etc., Oasis.
Yeah, and there was hits and there was misses, like there is with any scene. I mean, I'll raise you Menswear, currently languishing in the Where Are They Now file. But there was also other bands like, you know, Echo Belly and Sleeper. They all had a few decent singles, but like you say, if you're talking about Lightning Charges, if you're talking about Hairs Down the Back of Your Neck, for me, it's Oasis.
Yeah, well, I would say I worked in a record shop. It wasn't just a record shop, because obviously we're talking pre-internet days,
yeah,
right? So we're talking, you know, physical music. There was a record shop, and underneath there was a mail order department. So people still used to send in for their records, checks, postal orders, and it was quite a big operation. And we specialised in Beatles. We sold more Beatles records than anyone else in the country. And one of my bosses, you know, he was just a complete Beatles head. He wouldn't hear a bad word about them. And unfortunately, because he was trying to pay less money, I guess, he lumbered himself with a couple of young staff, myself included, because obviously our wages must have been the cheapest you can possibly pay. But after we got this copy in the shop of Definitely Maybe, I remember turning around to him, you know, my naive way, and I said, this band will be bigger than the Beatles. And there was genuinely a moment, Doug, when I thought, I'm right. They nearly, this, in my mind, I thought they're going to be bigger than the Beatles because they were so big.
And I think there was another thing. They just, I'm not 100% sure what the term zeitgeist means, but I think I'm using it in the right context. Everything just came together at one point, which sort of culminated in Nebworth. The Stone Roses had sort of disappeared, and whether it was record company wranglings or heroin addictions or whatever else the tabloids were pumping out at the time, they never fulfilled the position for me that they should have done. And I think Oasis just shimmied in there quite nicely. You know, they were naughty enough to capture the football end of the market. They were photogenic enough to capture the sort of teenage girl end of the market. They had absolutely everything in between. And like you say, because of that sort of Beatles influence and 60s influence, they sort of picked up maybe some older fans that other bands couldn't, and everything just sort of fell into place.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was almost irresistible. I think we mentioned briefly Nirvana before, and obviously that was such a big album, Nevermind, and it took, it was not just, you know, America and this country by storm. I'm sure it took, you know, most of the world by storm. And when Kurt Cobain, you know, died, it kind of, it felt like there was a gap. It opened up this whole gap. And I think Oasis just kind of slid in there at some point. And then they kind of filled this little void that had been left by, you know, Nirvana ending and people being not so much interested in the other bands that had come along with them. And everyone just picked them up. Everyone just jumped on and went for the ride.
See, I remember it slightly differently, and that might be my age or, you know, the fact that I was sort of came from a slightly different direction. And I have to say that I took the title Nevermind as an order rather than anything else. And it's just nice that you've actually got a band that looks like a band instead of a load of scruffy layabouts on a work scheme.
I think you're right. When you talk about it was British, wasn't it? It was British.
100% British.
It was an entire British movement, and for quite a significant period of time, the country were pretty much behind it. I mean, there was a great bands like Supergrass. Thought they were great bands.
Yeah,
for example,
like I say, great singles bands that have released a load of good singles. And my children, I'm lucky; they've sort of got the guitar music thing. So they've got Radio X on all the time, and those singles don't sound out of place now. I mean, that might just be to my age and ears, but for me, they don't sound out of place at all, and they still sound as vibrant and as exciting as they did when I heard them in 95, 96. I think it's all stood up really, really well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. So, because you're right, they were big singles. They were just, it was big, catchy music, yeah. A lot of it. I mean, there was so many bands, and you know, hit and miss. There was hit and miss bands. For every Blur, there was a Menswear. For every Oasis, there was
Northside.
What was? Yeah, that's a great example.
Northern Uproar.
Or These Animal Men. There was so many of them. But there was actually, like, I mean, I was thinking the other day, and I don't know, it popped in my head, and I tried looking for it on a streaming service, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I can't remember his name. I think it's Danny Goffey. I think he was the drummer in Supergrass.
Yes.
His wife Pearl was in a band called Powder, and they released a single called Aphrodisiac, which had this big towering chorus. They weren't a particularly good band. I don't know if they made anything else after that, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And eventually I did. I found it on YouTube and I just thought, this is a great record. Why isn't it on like Spotify or Apple Music? So I guess a lot of that stuff has probably been lost a bit.
Do you think it's because there was just so much coming out at that time? Because I remember I was working in Parsons Green at that point, and we used to go up to HMV, you know, every Monday on the North End Road, and all the record companies were banging out CD singles for 99p for the first week. We just go and take handfuls of these things, you know, anything that looked vaguely British, vaguely guitar-y every Monday. And there must have been a right load of rubbish in there, but I think it all sank without a trace because there was just too much for Radio 1 to stay on top of.
Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, I wasn't alive in the initial punk movement or the punk scene, but I guess it was kind of similar to that. Record labels just were scrabbling to sign any band that they could associate with that Britpop kind of sector or movement. And that's why there was so much coming out, wasn't it? They were all trying to make a quick buck.
No, I think that's a brilliant comparison. The Mod Revival's probably another one. You know, all of a sudden, you've got bands like Secret Affair and The Chords, who are half decent, being backed up with all sorts of nonsense just because somebody had a Target t-shirt and sat on a Vespa in their photos.
I mean, and obviously that's in the days of physical music, where if you're a record label and you could invest a tiny bit of money in, you know, four lads who could play their instruments a little bit, put them in a studio for a day, you might be able to actually make something. But I guess in the days of, you know, streaming and, you know, not really buying music per se, or for most people, that's not really viable anymore. So that's been lost. I would have thought, I might be entirely wrong, but I would have thought that there's no real money in doing that anymore. So that seems, if that's the case, say it might not be, I might be wrong, but if that's the case, it's kind of sad, because that would limit, you know, especially youth movements musically.
Definitely. I think you're right there. And, you know, the other thing that, and again, I don't want to sound like an old man, and I know that you've been through this a couple of times with different people on this podcast, but streaming makes people lazy. And I don't think that, you know, obviously I don't do this anymore, but I can see my older son doing it, who's 17. You know, going to those little gigs, finding those little records in rough trade, subscribing to, you know, vinyl subscription services. It's a tiny minority of teenagers that are doing that, but that's what I did, and I'm guessing that's what you did. And you went in for all three acts, not just for the main act, because you wanted to see the support bands. And the first time I saw the Wonder Stuff, they were, I think, third on the bill to Balaam and the Angel at the old 100 Club. If we hadn't gone in early because we were anoraks, we'd have never seen them. And then all of a sudden we're confronted with these mad Brummies with huge big bobs shouting, you know, I didn't like you very much when I met you, and now I like you even less. And we're like, wow, who are these fellas? This is fantastic. But we'd have never seen those kind of bands, you know, if you hadn't been into that, I've got to find more, I've got to find more, I've got to find more mentality. And I just think that now that you can click a button and basically find the greatest hits of everyone, people are going to miss some of those, you know, real massive finds.
Yeah, I think it's part of this kind of age of unlimited information and unlimited data. You know, if we go back to before that, where you'd have to buy an enemy, you'd have to buy a Melody Maker.
Yeah.
You find out about things via word of mouth, by going to gigs. As you said, you go to a gig, you know, when I was young, I used to go to a gig at Brixton Academy. I'd look at the ticket, it would just say plus special guests 90% of the time. It never said who the support bands were going to be. You didn't know until you got there.
Absolutely. And I remember going to Hammersmith, you had the Odeon, which was usually, you know, some massive chart act. But then you had the Clarendon and the Palais round the corner. I remember queuing up for the Clarendon and talking to somebody in the queue for the Palais and asking them who they were going to see, and swap queues, because it sounded more interesting than the band that I was originally going to see. But again, you know, I know it's a bygone era, but for me, that's where the real excitement in music was. And like you say, plus special guests, well, who's it going to be? I better get in there at, you know, 7:03 and stand near the front, because it might be someone great.
Yeah, definitely. Like me and my mates, we never went in late, unless there was a particular reason, but we'd always try and get there early. You want to get your money's worth, and say you might see the next band that you fall in love with. You know, as per your story with Wonder Stuff,
yeah.
you just had to know. But it's a completely different time. But I tell you, I want to go back to me. This is one question I want to ask you, because you mentioned two things that put together kind of interests me a little bit. You mentioned you've got a bit of an obsessive nature.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Which I totally understand.
It's a huge, huge understatement. Worryingly.
It's something I identify with because I've got that within myself as well. But you mentioned that, and you also mentioned not just as we've been talking, but when you sent me your email with the music you love and that, you mentioned Northern Soul. And I was wondering, how does something as, you know, like Northern Soul, which is kind of seems to me anyway, like an endless map of records, go with someone who's quite obsessive? I imagine that could end up quite like a big relationship because Northern Soul, it seems like the ultimate kind of record collector's type music to be into.
It is. And when I first got into Northern Soul, as I say, it was kind of the jam and then Motown. And then, you know, we started to meet older lads through, whether it's, you know, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, local gigs, whatever. And they started talking about Northern Soul. And then you get lent, you know, a Max LC60 that somebody had recorded. And then you'd start going to, I know, is it Cheam you're from, Colin?
Yeah, I'm from Cheam.
So we used to go to the Epsom Playhouse, which had a thing called the 60s Disco, and we thought it was going to be, you know, Dead End Street by the Kinks and My Generation by the Who. But obviously when you get in there, it's just pure Northern Soul, but they'd had to change the name because of all the furore in the tabloids. They'd have never got the night hired. So after that, you started hearing some brilliant records. Then you started buying all the compilation LPs. I do have a box of 7 inches still tucked away somewhere safe at home because I was starting to get into it. Then I had children, so it no longer became practical. But at that point, loads and loads of compilations came out. So I have obsessively collected all the tracks via those compilations, and I've made my own playlists and all of that kind of thing. But I managed just to wean myself off the heavy drugs of 7-inch collecting just at the right time, I think. But I don't know how many compilations I've got, but it's probably about a third of my iTunes, I would think, Club Soul and Northern Soul in some capacity. So, yeah, I did it the cheap way.
Mind you, it would have, I mean, you know, delving hard into that, it would have paid dividends because as someone that like, tries to, you know, but I don't buy a lot of vinyl, I can't afford to, but, you know, I'm always looking for particular things or bargains. You know, I'm on a lot of different groups on Facebook and things like that for selling and buying vinyl. And some of those Northern Soul records go for an absolute fortune now. It's eye-watering.
I mean, it's really not uncommon to hear something going for $3,000 or $4,000. And that's not a fairly staple song. And let's remember, those Northern Soul songs, they were never chart hits. These were things that were sort of played on college radio in the back end of Detroit in 1964. So it's not like you're even buying a famous record. You're paying for rarity, which, you know, I don't want to get all deep and meaningful about this because it's probably not very interesting for a lot of the listeners. But there's something that doesn't sit well with me that people are making that much money on a 7-inch single that probably cost 20 cents at the time. And the artist and the producer and the writer are picking up nothing. You know, these guys have died in abject poverty somewhere in Chicago or Detroit, wherever it might be, but there's still a whole load of people with these, you know, cargo trunks going around from venue to venue, making an absolute killing on these records. For me, that doesn't sit right. So I'm happy to buy the licensed compilations because then I get, you know, 25, 30 tracks that I really, really want, but it's not costing me the earth.
Yeah, you're totally right where you're coming from. I mean, it's a collector's market, isn't it? Like anything kind of niche or anything like that people pay for. I mean,
You're paying for rarity, not quality.
Absolutely. If you're a completist, you know, these people are completists, aren't they, to the point where, you know, their collection is not complete without that one or two records that they're missing. So,
mate, I've been to nights where they won't even accept a UK pressing, even if it was the first pressing. You've got to play the original US or you're not, you can't DJ. Like, I only want to go and have a couple of beers and a dance.
Yeah, that is.
I can't go that far because I genuinely enjoy all the music.
I do like Northern Soul. I don't know. If I'm honest, Doug, I never delved too deep into it. I started to, and what I found was this labyrinth of music, and I kind of felt probably a bit overwhelmed with it. I was just trying to think of like one of my favourite tracks, and I don't, you know, embarrassingly, I can't remember the artist, but the track's called Landslide. I'm sure it's a very common song.
Tony Clark.
That's it, Tony Clark. That you know,
fantastic record.
I'm not much of a dancer, Doug, right? So I'm from the days of going to gigs, jumping up and down. You know, I can't move my body in free and fluid ways, especially not now. But, you know, it wouldn't matter the situation if I was at a house party, a garden party, if I was in a club, wherever it was. If the DJ put on Landslide, it would be irresistible to me not to move, I think.
But I think there's probably 500 or 600 records like that when you start listening to it. And that's kind of what I like. And we'll come back to some of these themes when we start talking about the album in question. But I want to be entertained. I don't care how depressing the lyrics are. I don't care if, you know, the singer's had his heart ripped out by the same woman 6 times. As long as you've got that, you know, the Tony Clark, the skipping drums and the heavy bass and the hand claps in there, I'm done. I'm sold.
You know, so that record particular, and it's something I do enjoy. I've got some CDs in the cupboard somewhere, Northern Soul ones, and I've got some stuff on the laptop as well. It's something I'll generally put onto playlists when, you know, if we're at a party or something like that, which we obviously don't at the moment, but as you briefly mentioned it, I think now's a good time to move along to the album.
Yes.
Let's talk about the album that I give you to listen to, Doug. Do you want to tell everyone what that album was?
It was an album called Nixon by a band called Lamb Chop.
Yep, it was released in February 2000, this album. You said, well, when I sent it to you, you said you'd never even heard of Lamb Chop, let alone listen to them. So it kind of worked out perfectly for me in terms of giving an album. It never works out perfect in terms of whether that person gets on with it or they don't. Well, for anyone that hasn't heard of Lamb Chop, which I'm sure there's plenty of it, Lamb Chop is essentially a guy called Kurt Wagner. I think there's been about 19 different members of that band over the years. First album was released in 94. They're from like Nashville, so they've got this alt-country kind of tag, which he pretty much dismisses. But it's, you know, fair to say they do have that sound about them, I think, anyway. I discovered them with their third album, Thriller. I'll tell you what, Doug, actually, if you look, I don't know if you have, you may well have already done this, I don't know, but if you haven't, if you go back into the back catalogue, the album Thriller, there's a track on it called Your Sunny Fucking Day, which, as a soul fan, I think you would like.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing like Nixon. It's a big, glorious summer song. So I recommend that to you and anyone else. And it was a critically acclaimed album in the UK. It didn't get much notice in the US, and at the time it was out, Kurt Wagner, he was still working a day job installing like wooden flooring. He actually came and played the Royal Albert Hall over here after it was released. And after he finished the gig, he had to fly back to Tennessee to carry on working, putting floors in. And I think after this record, he eventually, you know, it became his proper job. But say, so you'd never heard them, you'd never heard the album. What were your initial thoughts with the album, Doug?
Where do I start with this? The first time I listened to it, I wasn't blown away, I'll be honest with you. What I thought was, and I'll stress the first time, but what I thought was, if Blur had come from Nashville, not Blur, if Pulp had come from Nashville, not Sheffield, it wouldn't have been a million miles away. So I think it's interesting that you say that he's trying to play down this all-county type thing, moniker, because I thought they were really British sounding. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they were actually met with more enthusiasm in Britain than they were in America. But after I listened to it a few times, I actually really grew to quite like it. There was 3 or 4 songs in particular that I thought were really, really good. And I kind of like my indie to punch me in the face. And this seemed more like a cleverly constructed insult than a punch, if that makes any sort of sense.
Yeah.
But the more
that
I listen to it,
that's a really good way of describing it.
I've listened to it several times and it's really grown on me. And like I said, I'd never heard of them. I did actually say to the guy that I work with, you know, that I was doing this and this was the album that I was given. And apparently he loves them, which he'd never mentioned before. But yeah, that was kind of my thing. It was, if Pulp had come from Nashville and they listened to a lot of the Avalanches, that this was probably, that's probably the closest that I could have got to it as a description.
Yeah, I like that description. If Pulp had come from Nashville, I can see entirely where you're coming from, because like at Pulp, up to a certain point, it was pretty, you know, out there, pretty unique. Like the early Pulp stuff, all the way up until, well, I suppose His and Hers maybe was when Pulp finally got some like critical attention. And I think Lamb Chop are kind of similar. Like even now they're established, but they still haven't got, they never had that big breakthrough. And I don't think they want to either. The way that Kurt Wagner is, I don't know how old he is now, but I think he's in his like late 50s, early 60s. But I totally get that. But like, I'm not even entirely sure why I picked this album for you, Doug. But I was just thinking about it while you were talking. And I think going back to your list of music, because there's the kind of soul thing runs through it. And I think it just popped into my head because for me, and you know, you might not agree, but it's just a feeling I have. There is a soul within Lamb Chop's music. It might not be.
There definitely is. There definitely is. And once we start looking at the tracks individually, there's a couple of comments that I'd make to back that up to the hilt. But the other thing that I would say is the podcast called The Best Album You've Never Heard. If you just plucked, I don't know, a 60s beat band or an obscure Motown act or a mid-90s indie band, there's probably quite a good chance that I would have heard either that or something very like it. So because of the ethos of the podcast, I think the choice was bang on. It was something I'd never heard before.
Yeah, I was really pleased. I didn't know whether you'd like it or not. And to be honest, Lamb Chop, it's not a band that many people I know actually like. And it's not, you know, Nixon's not an album that I could say, oh yeah, no, all my mates, they love it. That's not the case at all. Most of them probably haven't even heard it. It's interesting to hear that. I think when you said you listened to the first time you listened to it, not so sure. It is a grower. Right, there's definitely no doubt about it. I can't disagree with that. I mean, like, I tried to pick albums.
I had to work on it to make it grow as well. You know, it wasn't just one of those things that it was okay the first time and by the fourth time it was pretty good. I did have to concentrate, but I don't have a problem with that because, you know, sometimes you've got to do it that way.
But that goes back to something that we discuss or I discuss with guests all the time on this podcast, as in buying an album and you've bought that album and it's not throwaway. You have to put it on and you have to listen to it because you'd just paid, you know, a lot of money for it at a time. And you would keep listening to it regardless if it didn't grab you immediately, you would just keep playing it. And some of my favorite albums come from that. I didn't necessarily like them too, like, you know, the first time I listened to them, they didn't grab me straight away. But because I kept playing and because I'd gone out and I'd spent money and I bought it, they became some of my favorite albums. And like, I try to give a record out that I've got like a personal connection with because we've got to talk about it.
Yeah.
And you know, when Nixon came out, there was quite a bit going on in my life, right? There was a lot of chaos and there was a lot of stress. And sometimes in those situations, like, life can get a bit loud, if that makes sense. It just can get a bit loud for you. And I used to put this record on and it kind of become my quiet place for a little while.
No, that,
you know,
makes
put
sense.
It on and, you know, it would block out everything else that was going on. So I listened to it a lot over probably a short period of time. And that's when eventually I fell in love with it. It overtook me again, not on the first listen, but I probably listened to it, you know, 100 times. So you had to listen to it a few times. Do you want to pick out some moments, Doug, some tracks perhaps?
Well, starting off with the first track, which I think is Old Gold Shoe. Having said Pulp, the reason that I corpsed on my lines and said Blur, all I could hear was that I can't remember which Blur song it is, but it's the one that says it really, really, really could happen. Do you know the song I mean?
Yeah.
I kind of heard that in the background all the way through.
I can't remember the song.
No, I really can't remember.
Is it something from The Great Escape?
Is it the Universal?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, but I kind of heard that in the background. What I scribbled down was Blur meets John Barry, because I think that's the other thing that came out for me right across the album, is it's quite cinematic. There's a lot of it that you could sort of imagine being filling in the gaps in some American indie film. So that was kind of my impression of that first song. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, Rock and Roll Star opening Definitely Maybe and it sort of kicking you in the bollocks, but this was such a mellow start to an album. I think that's what might have put the question marks up in my mind to start with. But once you actually let yourself go into it and you do sort of appreciate the size of the track, I just liked it more and more.
Yeah, it's a pretty brooding kind of opener. You know, there's mournful strings on it. I think from up until this album, Lamb Chop didn't really sound like that, or not in my experience. I think it's all down to the producer they had in the studio. I think they went into a studio, they got given a producer, and I can't remember the guy's name. I should do, but I can't. And I think he was the one who kind of took this music that they were kind of making in, they should be just playing in little clubs in Tennessee and stuff. He kind of took it and he added like the strings and the horns and everything else and sort of gave it this grand sort of sound. So I think it's the producer that's kind of dragged them along.
And it is a really, really, I'm not going to say overly produced album, but it's a very produced album. There are an awful lot of tracks going on there, to the point, I think, in the next track, Grumpus, there might be too much going on, but that's only for that track. The rest of it, I think it works really, really well. But there is a depth. There are horns, there's choirs, there's strings, there's arrangements, there's competing guitar lines. There's all sorts of stuff in it. You know, if you like your music, simple and straightforward, this probably might grate on you because there is an awful lot in the audio.
There is a lot going on in Grumpus. I do like Grumpus, though. It's got a nice little groove to it. It has got lush strings.
Yeah, and it picks up pace a little bit as well, which was does. Good because after, it is a mournful first track.
Yeah, after the opener, it does suddenly pick the pace up a bit. I think you're right. I don't know if Kurt Wagner's supposed to be Grumpus. I like to think he is for some reason. I don't know, but there's a line in it, and it's something like he sings something like, part of the process is sifting through the piles of shit that tells us you don't mind a bit. And I don't know why, but it always sort of stuck with me. I might have got that wrong, but it always stuck with me. And I kind of took it to mean, things will be all right, even if you've got to like dig through some shit once in a while.
Yeah, we all have to.
I'll tell you what, let's play a little bit of Grumpus now. Over to you, Doug, if you want to
Thing that I was going to say is, as I listened to it maybe the second and third time, have you ever come across the album Shaken Not Stirred by David Arnold?
Yeah, I do remember it. I don't remember it well enough because David Arnold was the kind of soundtrack guy, right, the cinematic guy.
Yeah, and he re-recorded a lot of the Bond themes with different artists, and that's kind of, I thought that album has a very similar sort of vibe to this one, especially some of the lesser known Bond themes like All Time High, which I think might come from Moonraker, I'm not sure. But it was, you know, it's very symphonic, it's very well produced, it's got all those different layers to it. And that was another comparison that sort of kept coming back to me, because I love that album.
I haven't got, the only David Arnold thing I've got is he did a track with Bjork called, I think it's called Play Dead. I've got the 12-inch of that still, but I do remember it coming out. I remember it being big there. It was a big seller in a mail order department for us. People like James Bond and they like music.
Yes, exactly.
The fourth track on the album, I think it's the fourth track anyway, Up With People, is by far the most well-known Lamb Chop song. I think if you go onto any of the streaming devices, right, Spotify, Apple Music, whatever it is, it will have the most plays. And that was, briefly, it was quite big over here, possibly in the indie charts, no more than that. But that's a song that I like because it starts really kind of, you know, pretty low key. And by the end of it, we've got a gospel choir singing.
Yeah, and you've also got, and this nagged me and nagged me and nagged me when I was listening to it. What's that riff? It's Big Audio Dynamite. There's a real Big Audio Dynamite type guitar riff in the background. It's I think it's almost note for note, which was kind of, I was distracted by the choir because I quite like a choir in the back of a record. But it was just that guitar and I was thinking, where's that come from? But if you listen to it again, I think it's, is it Medicine Show? It's one of those early Big Audio Dynamite records. And the riffs literally lifted off it, which kind of gave it a little bit more familiarity for me. But I thought it had, again, just a really, really British kind of 90s indie sound to it. And again, it just picked it up a gear again, which is sort of the way that I like an album to go.
Well, that's an interesting point you made there. I do know Big Audio Dynamite. I don't know him well enough to pick out a line like that.
I only know the singles.
I'll go and listen.
I only know the singles, to be honest, and which are fine. But I think you'll smile when you hear. It's definitely one of those records. When you hear the guitar riff, you'll smile.
Well, as we're talking about, and as I particularly like this song, let's play a bit of Up With People so
great
people can maybe hear the line themselves.
Yeah, there comes a booming sound. Used to come from underground. Now it emanates from a kind of welfare state. Of the soul, yeah, baby, of the soul. Love that sweet, sweet song. Let's be certain, the deliberate monologue. As sure as if it will fall across you, unto you. Will most certainly leave the doing undone. Come on and then, come on and then. Screwing up our lives today, 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 up our lives today. This we've planted. Come on, Project Man. Come on.
The next track on the album, Nashville Parent, that's a track I quite like. Again, it's got some kind of freaky lyrics. He says something like, I don't want a freak, but the tongue erodes each time we speak. Which is kind of, I don't know, that again is another line that's stuck in my head. I feel as this record goes on, it starts getting heavier, if that makes sense. It never gets heavy, but it goes right from, you know, from the Old Gold Shoe to the last track, which is particularly heavy. But I feel like as the album goes along, it does start getting heavier, and this is kind of where it starts.
Well, the other thing is, and I don't know if this is on purpose, because I hadn't even thought of it until you just said that, the overproduction, I think, kind of, what's the right way to phrase this? It almost takes the onus off the lyrics, because some of the lyrics are really, really challenging and pretty dark. But because you've got happy guitar riffs and you've got a little bit of choir, and, you know, we'll come on to some of the later songs where he's even experimenting with a kind of falsetto, it sort of takes your attention away from just how pointed some of the lyrics are, because he's tackling some hard shit in this.
Yeah, and he's not a artist that really talks about what he's writing about. He kind of, he's very dismissive when people ask him about his lyrics, and he sort of, his kind of standard go-to is like, don't take it too seriously, it's not worth digging into, and he'll never kind of be pulled on that stuff.
And I think it's also, it's explicit enough for you to know that there's something going on there, but it's abstract enough for him to be able to say, and don't look too much into it, because he's obviously got some sort of element of privacy in there and doesn't want to let people too far in. But yeah, there's some pretty pointed stuff there.
Yeah, there is. And as the album moves on, so it gets a bit heavier. There's the track Petrified Florist, which I do really like. It is quite dark sounding, like sonically. It's got these big noises that run through it, along with like quite harsh sounding brass. And again, I've got absolutely no idea what the track's about, who the Petrified Florist is, and what a Petrified Florist is exactly. I don't know, but that's a track that kind of, I think, you know, you're getting to the end of the album by that point.
Petrified Florist, it's, again, for me, that was really, I know we've jumped ahead here, but that was really, really quite Bond-esque. You can almost have that in the background of with a Bond villain. And the opening salvo, to me, it almost sounded like Bauhaus or something quite gothic.
Yeah. And, that's, you know, quite, that's interesting.
Not really my cup of tea, but just the way that it riffed. And then, again, talking about the lyrics, the ones that I picked out of that song, the closing of the core, the blistered, buttered, raw, oh, callous even hand in the village of the damned. Now, if that's not a Sisters of Mercy lyric, what is?
Yeah, you're quite right. I say it does get dark as we go along. When we get to the end of the album, Butcher Boy. Now, it's the loudest track on the album, for me anyway. And we talked about dark. You know, this is a dark track. I mean, it's basically about a girl who commits suicide because her beloved butcher boy loves someone else. I mean, it's really dark. Her father finds her, cuts her down, and she's got a note on her telling him to dig her a grave. It's
sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. But again, what's he done? He's put a big thumping brass track on it, lovely skipping drum track. It probably, and, you know, apologies for sounding like Alan Freeman, but it rocks more than any other track on the album. But like you say, it is dark. Imagine taking suicide notes off your teenage daughter.
But it's
what a
really
fantastic,
dark.
You know, what a fantastic track. If you didn't know that was the theme, you've just got a really good rock record.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of telling, or it is for me, and it always has been, that if you listen to the album from beginning to end, it starts the way it does. It starts, you know, fairly quiet, and it just constantly builds as it goes. And you get to this track, and it's the loudest point, and it feels like it should be the end of the album. And that's something else I love about it, just that the entire thing builds as you go along.
No, completely agree.
But let's play a bit of Butcher Boy now. Let's share some of the misery so the listeners can hear it as well.
She went upstairs to make her bed, and not a word to her mother said. upstairs too. Say, daughter, daughter, what troubles you?
Oh, mother, oh, mother, oh, mother, I cannot tell. That butcher, that boy I love so well. He courted, he courted, he courted my life away. And now at home, he will not stay. A place in London town, where that butcher, that boy, he goes and sits down and takes that strange girl on his knee and tells her, and tells her, and tells her what he won't tell me. Father came home from work. Say, my daughter, my daughter, my daughter, she looks so hurt. He went upstairs, upstairs to give her hope. And found her, and found her, and found her hanging from a rope.
It sounds like you engaged well with the record, Doug. It sounds like you said you did like it. You know, it took a bit of time, but I'm pleased that you got to spend some time with it and you got something out of it.
I definitely got something out of it. And like I've said, it did take a couple of listens, which I don't have any issue with whatsoever. What I was dreading was coming on here and just sort of grunting and giving it 1 out of 10, which is not the case because I actually really like the album now.
No, I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased. I'd say the last two episodes have been a bit of a kind of a bust, really. The Ben Rushworth didn't like the album. I knew he wasn't going to like that, to be honest. That's my fault. And Dave Stevenson wasn't overly keen on things. But that's the nature of, you know, sharing music around, isn't it? You're just sort of giving people, this is my recommendation. You might not like it, you might love it. And the times that you find something that you do like, I think it's a bonus.
Yeah. And, you know, we've already talked about experimenting and, you know, just trying to push the tendrils out a bit further and find something new. This is something new to me. Will I go back to it? Yes, I will. Will I now go back and listen to Thriller? Yes, I will. So thanks very much for that.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. I mean, look, we've played a few of the songs, Doug. Out of the songs we haven't played yet, if you could pick one song to play for the listeners, what song would it be?
What Else Could It Be, which I think is about halfway through the album. For me, it's the one where he really starts to experiment with what sounds to me like a Curtis Mayfield type falsetto. It's got a really soul-y feel to it. Almost sounds like, you know, the last couple of albums that the Style Council put out. It's got that kind of groove on it. And then towards the end, you've got those real bam, bam, bam sort of timestamps that maybe an Al Green or a Curtis Mayfield 70s kind of soul setup would use, which I'm a sucker for, which you've probably guessed from the conversation that we've had. But for me, What Else Could It Be? What a lovely, lovely soul record. And a little bit of a surprise halfway through the album.
Fantastic. This is What Else Could It Be?
Thank you.
Okay, so I always ask Doug, if you had to give the album a score out of 10, what would you give it?
7.
Okay, it's a good score. It's a good score.
I think it was a grower. Do you know what? In 2 weeks, it might be an 8, but today it's a 7. And like I say, it was brand new to me. And if anything that I've said this afternoon has made sense to any of the listeners, it's on Spotify. Give it a whack. It is a really, really interesting record.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it is an album you need to spend a bit of time with. If you're the kind of person that, you know, you put something on and if you don't like it, you turn it off immediately, then, you know, don't bother, sort of thing. But if you want to spend a bit of time with a record that may well reward you in the long run, definitely give it a go. I mean, when I gave it to you, I hadn't listened to Nixon for, I don't know, probably a couple of years. And I gave you the album and I was doing something and I put it on. And I was sort of halfway through and I thought, this is not going to be, like, why have I picked this? I thought this is like so inaccessible in a way. I don't know whether Doug's going to like it. So I'm so pleased that you did get something out of it. I really am.
No, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's going over old ground. I had to work to get there, but I'm bloody glad I did.
All right. That was Lamb Chops Nixon and that was Doug McPherson. Doug, thank you again for spending this time with me. You know, it was a brilliant chat, mate. I really, really enjoyed it.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And thanks again for inviting me on. I didn't know if I could actually talk that long, but you made it really, really easy and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
No, it's been brilliant. You've got an opportunity. If there's any, you want to tell anyone where they can find you, either your socials or your business or anything. Some people do, some people don't.
You can listen to me spouting more rubbish through Twitter at Doug McP. Or we do run our own podcast called the 10 and a half Coffee Cast, which is all about marketing and business development. So if neither of those tick a box for you, probably not worth listening. But if you're involved in either of those industries in any sort of capacity, you might get something out of it and you'd be more than welcome to join us on there.
Get on that. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BAYNH Podcast. Until next time, keep discovering new music.
This podcast is part of the After Dark Podcast Network.